We will later be convening the Senate Higher Education Budget Division, but for now, we are organized as a policy division. And our first testimony will come from some previously scheduled groups that weren't able to complete their work when they came last time. So I think Minitex is here to talk with us, and please come forward and introduce yourselves to us. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the division, my name is Bill DeJohn, the Director of Minitex, an information and resource sharing program of the Minnesota Office of Higher Education and the University of Minnesota Libraries. I believe the division visited the university last month and heard from Wendy Loger, the university librarian, about the services of the university libraries, of which Minitex is a division. Minitex also administers the MinLink Gateway service program, which is funded by the legislature. Minitex Appropriations supports the Gateway program with our staff and our resources. I want to thank you for the increase in funding you provided Minitex during the current biennium, and we have been expending those funds to provide increased services to students and faculty and state government employees in Minnesota. This has also allowed us to continue leveraging our services to Minnesota public and school libraries. I understand the challenges you face during this current economic environment, and we are trying to use all the talent we have and our staff to maintain our services as we receive a reduction in our base budget. Turning to the salmon handout that I believe you all have, we consider ourselves a cornerstone of the statewide library community. You'll notice that our services include, but we don't have everything here, resource sharing. You can see that last year in fiscal 08, we provided over 90,000 loans of books and photocopies of articles from the University of Minnesota Twin City Campus Libraries to the rest of the state of Minnesota, as well as an additional 190,000 loans and photocopies from other libraries in our three-state region, Minnesota, South Dakota, North Dakota, and we have reciprocity with Wisconsin. Minitex is 40 years old this year, and we've been working with all three of these states and Wisconsin for most of that period. We also have a delivery system that links the libraries together throughout Minnesota for effective delivery of information back and forth throughout the library community and from our office to the libraries throughout the state.
Excuse me. Would it be all right with you if I asked you just a quick question here for context? Are you able to tell me, when you give us these numbers for year 2008, are you indicating to us an increase? Is this a typical of the level of service that you're providing in terms of resource sharing? Are you doing more, doing less? Is it about the same? Is it stable? Is it a consistent demand?
If you look at the third page, top graph, we have had a steady increase in volume of requests. This information from the University of Minnesota Libraries is an increase over the previous years.
Thank you very much. Continue.
Our cooperative purchasing program has been in existence since about 1989, and we have been saving libraries in Minnesota millions of dollars throughout this period. In fiscal 08, we saved the 72 academic libraries, four-year colleges and two-year colleges, private and public, about $31 million through our cooperative purchasing and negotiating with vendors for scholarly materials and other information that many of these libraries would not have. We've leveraged the University of Minnesota Library subscriptions so that libraries throughout the state would have access to 20, 30, 40, 50 times more than they can afford themselves. The Electronic Library for Minnesota, which is also funded by the legislature, is something we administer, and we've been operating that for several years. You can see from the graphs on the third, I believe that's on the last page, that we continue to have an increase. We had over almost 13 million searches in the Electronic Library for Minnesota last year. And then MinLink Gateway, which is a program that you fund, and you have a brochure that explains that virtual library service. That particular program provides anyone in Minnesota with a public library card access to over 33 million volumes. They can search all of those volumes from their home or their business or their school or their library and actually borrow materials through that system. And we leverage the Minitex delivery system to move that material back and forth between Rochester, Thief River Falls, Duluth, Worthington, you have it. We move the stuff back and forth between the libraries. On the second page, you can see the increase in demands that you mentioned earlier. In resource sharing, we've seen a 34% increase. Our delivery system is 142% increase in the last 5 years. The Minling Gateway is a 274% increase because it's patron-initiated. The patron, the citizen of Minnesota, can initiate a loan from their home. Many of them do it overnight on the weekends, especially because every Monday we receive 1,000 to 2,000 requests from this system, which indicates, I believe, that it's being used over the weekend by people who are interested in getting books and CDs and DVDs and whatever they need from the library community. And then a 61% increase in the electronic library for Minnesota searching over the last 5 years. Minitex has a multiplier effect for every dollar spent at the state level. We provide access to many resources for local libraries that they would not be able to afford on their own. Through Minitex and the Gateway, we share existing resources that have been purchased by local libraries with each other throughout Minnesota. And through our cooperative purchasing and group discount programs, we help local libraries stretch their limited dollars. The budget reductions would also have a multiplier effect across the libraries as we deal with the reductions that we're looking at, especially at a time when library usage is skyrocketing. What happens in local libraries, and you've seen the newspaper articles, is when the local libraries are busier, we become busier because there's a trickle-up effect, if you will, as people begin to ask for information that local libraries may not have, and then they begin asking the network, and we end up satisfying those needs. On the bottom of that page, you can see the recommended 10% reductions would have an impact on Minitex services in terms of either delaying delivery from the university as well as reducing staff in fiscal 11. The increases on the graphs, I think you can see that it's nothing but going up, and we'll be dealing with that probably for the next few years. I'd be very happy to stand for any questions if you have any.
Are there any questions from the committee? Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. DeJean. It's my understanding, is this system funded solely by the state of Minnesota?
$400,000 state appropriation on an annual basis for the software maintenance involved, but the local libraries contribute their own materials and their own staff time to the system.
Are there any questions? Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Mr. DeJean. And so along those lines, there are a small number of libraries in the state of Minnesota who do not have, or their users do not have access to this system. Am I correct on that? And can you offer some explanation?
Madam Chair, Senator Lynch, I believe that those libraries are not part of their regional public library systems. And so with our contract with the Minnesota Department of Education, we follow their policy, and those libraries do not have access within those city boundaries to MinLink or Minitex services.
Senator Lynch.
Madam Chair, Mr. DeJean, and if I may, so is it your understanding that that is due to a contract stipulation between the department and those libraries? What I'm trying to get at is that it seems to me that this is a system that is state-funded, and I'm troubled by the fact that there are some library systems within the state of Minnesota that their patrons do not have access to this system.
It's my understanding.
Go ahead.
Madam Chair,
thank
Senator
you.
Lynch.
Mr. DeJean.
It's my understanding that's the policy of the Department of Education, which we follow as part of our contract with them.
Okay, Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Lynch.
Madam Chair, you know this issue.
Yes,
as
I do.
Well, and I would just suggest that this is an area that I would hope to continue to do some work on, because I think fundamentally that this is a very good system and has lots of good things to offer the state of Minnesota. But fundamentally, I believe that it is wrong that there are certain localities by design that are excluded from this statewide appropriated system. And I hope to continue working with Senator Sharon and others on that issue.
And just to follow through a little further, I want to make sure I clearly understand the funding stream. Would you go through that again, Mr. DeJean? You have $400,000 that is appropriated from the state. And
Madam
that goes
Chair,
where?
Madam Chair, there's a $400,000 appropriation from the legislature in the higher education budget to the Office of Higher Education. The higher Office of Higher Education has the contract with the vendor that provides the software and hardware that runs the Mendeling Gateway. That's about $190,000, I believe, yearly contract. Then there's another amount of money that is prorated among the 24 libraries in the participating column, which is roughly $5,000 or $6,000 per institution for their contributions, if you will, to the network. We receive approximately $58,000-$60,000 for one staff member in my operation, if you will. And so that's how it's distributed, and it comes through us. It comes to us through our contract between the Office of Higher Education and the University of Minnesota for Minitech Services. So that's the funding stream.
In terms of the appropriation, you may not be the person for me to ask this, but I'll ask it, and then you can redirect me for the information. Is it your understanding that it would be within the authority of the legislature to put a rider in relationship to this $400,000 that would say that you could not exclude any library on any basis, including their choice to not participate in a regional library system?
Madam Chair, it's my understanding the legislature can do pretty much whatever it wants.
That's the point I'm trying to make. Thank you for helping me with that. Is there any other further questions? Is there anything further you'd like the committee to know?
No, thank you for your time.
I really appreciate. Sorry, are there others that are here that are going to be presenting?
Not on this, is my understanding, Madam Chair.
Is there anyone else in the audience that we have a list of names here? I'm just not certain.
Network.
So the Learning Network is going to be presenting next. We have a quorum. I'd like to announce for the tape that we now have a quorum.
Madam Chair.
Thank you. Please introduce yourself to the committee. Welcome.
My name is Steve Cawley. I'm the Vice President for Information Technology at the University of Minnesota. I also serve as the Vice Chair of the Learning Network Board.
Madam Chair and Senators, my name is Ken Neamey. I'm the Vice Chancellor for Information Technology for the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities, and I currently serve as Chair of the Learning Network Board. And as an executive decision, seeing as I'm chair, I decided that my junior partner here, the vice chair, will be going through the materials that we have to present today. But we oversee the activities of the Learning Network on a joint basis and the partnership with the University of Minnesota in technology is very, very important for us and for the University of Minnesota as well.
Madam Chair, members of the committee,
Please introduce yourself and say your name for the record.
Steve Cawley, University of Minnesota.
Thank you.
We've provided a very brief description and a little fold-out piece of information that should be at your table. So the Learning Network of Minnesota, is a network, first and foremost. It's the education component of the statewide integrated network managed by the Office of Enterprise Technology. The Learning Network provides internet, data, voice, and video services to support academic programs and administrative services at the state's public higher education campuses. The Learning Network brings advanced services such as Internet 2 as well to each of these campuses. The Learning Network is governed by a statewide board of directors in conjunction with six regional policy boards that manage the regional day-to-day activities of the network. As we stated, my colleague Ken Neamy, the vice chancellor from Minsky, is the chair of that board, and I serve as the vice chair. The board is made up of representatives from each of the individual regional boards, and that board provides the overall governance, including budget oversight, architectural design, policy setting, and strategy setting. The Learning Network provides many benefits to the University of Minnesota system and the Minsky system. Its services are critical in the effective delivery of education, first and foremost, especially distance education. In the early days, this was often viewed as an ITV network, interactive television network. It's grown far, far beyond that, although interactive television is still a component that rides on the Internet backbone of the Learning Network. It also provides video conferencing services for administrative services to reduce travel expenses on our campuses. It promotes and supports the adoption of new cost-saving technologies, such as internet-based telephone services that have reduced costs on many of our campuses. It provides a variety, it essentially provides the core infrastructure for all of our network-based online learning systems. And one thing to keep in mind as we look at the tough budget situation we're facing is that every dollar invested in the Learning Network and in our collaborative cost-sharing pooling of our resources, we've calculated provides almost $2 in value back to the campuses. It's really the power of shared purchasing and shared management of complex infrastructure. So we were asked to comment on how the cuts would affect the Learning Network. The 10% cut that we're looking at right now will have an impact, like it will all of us in the state. It's important to note that the Learning Network budget is used primarily, almost 90% of that budget is used to aggregate and buy services. And so a cut to this budget has a direct impact on service levels and our capacity to buy network-based services and application services on top of that network. Some specific examples. Right now we have a joint project between Minsky and the U of M and the Learning Network looking at a shared streaming video service. And if you've ever been out to YouTube, you understand what a streaming video service is. But we have a need on each of our campuses to have, for distance education and on-campus education purposes, to provide a robust repository and delivery system for all of our classroom and other streaming video needs. And we've calculated that the best way to do this is to do this as a shared collaborative across these six regions and with the Minsky system and the U of M. This cut will have an impact on our ability to make that investment and may force us to cancel that investment. It may also force us to delay some of our planned network upgrades. This is broadband network. And as our campuses grow in terms of their use of this network and use of online technology like distance learning, we have to every year increase the capacity. So we use this budget to buy more broadband capacity for our campuses. So our ability to do that will be restricted, and we may have to delay some of those upgrades. We also may have to delay some of the upgrade of some of the video conferencing equipment in some of our classrooms across the two systems. So I think that concludes my comments.
Thank you. Is there anything further?
I have nothing more to add.
Are there any questions? Thank you very much.
So we're in policy committee? Yeah. Senator, is Senator Dill here?
That I meant to ask a question of the former presenter from Minitex if he's still here.
He's Mr. DeJohn, he's not here.
Page.
Cara,
if it would be possible, is there anybody here that
is anyone else here from Minitex? They went to go get him.
Ah, there he is.
There you go. Okay, could you just join us at the table for a minute? Senator Sharon has a question.
I'm sorry.
Hold on just a minute, Senator Dill.
Thank you, Senator Pappas. Mr. DeJohn, I'm sorry. I meant to ask this question, and then we focused on another issue. You were talking about one of the consequences of the cuts to the budget would be the delay of the responsiveness of the system to the volume of requests for response. I was just curious if you could talk about what that means in real numbers. How rapidly are you responding now, and what would be the amount of delay? What are we talking about? Actually, the people will have to experience.
Mr. DeJohn.
Madam Chair, Senator, with the dollars you gave us for this biennium, we've increased our hours. We're now actually operating from 7 a.m. to 11 p.m. Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. on Saturdays in order to move the volume of requests, which are 5,000 or 6,000 requests a week, through our system. It's a production operation. If we fall behind at all, it creates a backlog, especially with 1,000 to 2,000 coming in every Monday. So if we reduce our staff in any way or have to reduce our hours, that's going to reduce our response time. Our current response time for materials that are held by the University of Minnesota, if it's a photocopy article, we are able to move things, actually fill requests within a few hours. Since we're scanning articles and delivering them to the desktop of students and faculty in the state, we actually are sending those the same day we receive the request in some cases, or at least overnight if it has to be a loan. If we have to refer to other libraries in Minnesota, North Dakota, South Dakota, Wisconsin, the ability of the staff to move that stuff through and make sure the item is available in another library before we send it to them is going to be affected by the staff reductions that we may have to look at. So it could be several more days in some cases, depending again on where the material is. If it's not at the university or the private colleges in the cities, it's going to take us longer to find it.
And Senator Pappas, so this effort to try to get things turned around, the portion of the work that you're turning around within a day or 24 hours, that might be delayed to 2 days? Or?
Could be even more, depending again on where we find the item.
Okay, thank you very much.
Do you still have the policy?
Okay,
all right, we'll ask Minsky. Okay, thank you very much, Mr. DeJohn. Senator Dill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate file number 644 is before you because we made a mistake last session. And one of the reasons we need to meet every year is to correct things that we do incorrectly. What you have before you is a bill to repeal some language that came from the House that says that, well, I'll just read the bottom of page one. On January 1st, 2009, the board must adopt a policy setting the maximum number of semester credits required for a baccalaureate degree at 120 semester credits or the equivalent, and the number of semester credits required for an associate degree at 60 semester credits or the equivalent. The board policy may provide for a process granting waivers for specific degree programs in which industry or professional accreditation standards require a greater number of semester credits. And then in addition to repealing that language, which I just read, there's another repealer for a report that is no longer necessary because what this bill effectively does is it returns to the Minsky board the authority to set policy on the number of credits required for various degrees. Now, I have a handout that I provided, which I want to highlight. And on one side, it talks about Senate File 644, Senator Dill, I got my name on there. We had a meeting at Ridgewater College at the end of last year, the first part of this year, and this handout was given to me. They are very upset there that we're reducing the requirements from 72 credits down to 60 for a two-year degree. Because a lot of these degrees that they provide there, the two-year degrees, are complicated degrees that require a lot of training. Life is not getting simpler. It's getting more complex, and it's not reasonable to be reducing credit requirements. But to me, the most important piece of information on this page is if you go down there to number 7, competitive programs in South Dakota, 80 credits. And we reduced ours to 60. That doesn't sound very good to me. North Dakota, 80 credits, and we're at 60. Iowa, 84 credits, and we're at 60 now. Wisconsin, 72 credits plus electives, and here we're at 60. Sounds like a second-rate program in Minnesota to me. And then you turn the page, and this deals specifically with the veterinary technology program. And here's the impact on that, and I'll read what I've got underlined there. Currently, the Ridgewater College Veterinary Technology Program has 75 credits. The only other Minsku college with a veterinary technology program is Rochester Community and Technical College. This program is 72 credits in length. The accrediting agency for veterinary technology programs is the American Veterinary Medical Association, which requires that programs teach very specific didactic materials on, as well as over 200 technical skills. Nationwide, almost all veterinary technology programs lead to an AAS degree, average 70 to 78 semester credits. If Ridgewater's college program are forced to reduce to 60 credit, there's absolutely no possibility of meeting accreditation requirements. So to me, this is clearly a mistake that was made in the last session. I'd like to see this language repealed and the authority for setting credit limits returned to the Minsku board where it belongs. And I believe there is two people on my list to testify.
Did you, the individuals from Minsku?
Yes.
Okay, Ms. Baer is here, and Mr. Lopez. Why don't you join Mr. Dill?
Madam Chair, may I ask a question?
Mm-hmm. Yes, Senator Senjum.
Madam Chair and Senator Dill, do you believe this was a technical mistake or a mistaken judgment?
Senator Dill.
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Senjum, it was in response to some students that didn't want to take all, they wanted to get their degree and spend less money doing it.
Okay. Senator Dill is correct that we were being sensitive, and the House was being sensitive, I think, to the cost of higher education. And I'm more sympathetic to the two-year issue than I am to the four-year issue, quite frankly. And I also think that Senator Wieger and I think, agree on this, is that if we got more of these general eds covered in the senior year of high school and had more rigorous programs in high school, we could probably get through, and students were taking some of the general programs through dual enrollment, we could probably get through in 2 years. I mean, we live in a competitive marketplace. In the European Union, they have three-year bachelor degrees because their system, the senior year is like the first year of college for their students. And they don't charge tuition either, like we do. So, sorry.
Go ahead. You can keep going.
Senator Dill, please continue.
Well, Madam Chair, I'm ready for the testifiers, other testifiers, to provide their...
Vice Chancellor Baer.
Thank you. Senator Pappas and Senators, I am Dr. Linda Baer, the Senior Vice Chancellor for the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. I'm here to speak to the issue that our board has determined it should be and has been up to this point their responsibility to set credit limits. We have examples from Ridgewater and others where issues will be extremely difficult for our campuses to provide the competency levels required in this 60 credit arena. However, also in the bill that became law, we had a waiver process. Dr. Lopez is here to speak to the fact that there was a considerable amount of work done to develop a waiver process. Mm-hmm. Within that process would be the opportunity for campuses to come forward and say why they thought their degree needed to be longer. I think that hearing from our technical colleges particularly, they are saying, why should technical education be under a waiver? Why should technical education be waived? A waiver to make do with what they should be doing in relation to adequate numbers of credits.
And we know we have a lot of programs in the technical colleges that vary in length. You can have a three-month or six-month certificate or a diploma or lots of different variations.
Chair Pappas, that's absolutely correct. So the issue is what should be waived and why, and that the board certainly has the authority and has up to this point had the responsibility to determine appropriate credit lengths without a waiver process. The last point I will make has to do with an additional clarification to the former bill that had to do with consistency. Why were some programs by the same name of various lengths? And that was another issue that we began to work on as well. But we did have a consultative process with the unions, with the students, about the process that brought us to a rather complicated and extensive waiver process.
Mr. Lopez?
Madam Chair, the process, just to elaborate slightly, for setting up the waivers is contained in the original bill on the sheets that were distributed here, would be lines 2.1 through 2.4, and it clearly indicates that waivers for specific programs in which there are industry or professional accreditation standards requiring a greater number of credits, that those types of programs would be granted a waiver. And that has been built into the process that we worked with student and faculty groups and other and campus administrators to put together.
Mr. Lopez or Dr. Baer, are you aware of programs that don't fit that narrow category that might want a waiver, but not for these reasons? Are there other reasons?
Chair Pappas, we did have quite a lengthy conversation, and there are new and emerging programs coming online, particularly as the economy changes. We have the requirement of building new programs and to have some sort of ceiling or barrier to being able to develop what industry is telling us they need and, in fact, have to go through a waiver process was the reason why unique or innovative programs would be important to us.
Have most of the requests for waivers been from the 60 credit, the two-year limit, or have you also had requests for the 120 semester credits?
Chair Pappas, currently we're on a timeline that says the waiver process is due to us by the end of June so that we can begin the process of now looking at the consistency issues. Most of the waivers that are being worked on campuses have to do with the two-year programs because it's such a dramatic difference of 60 to the likelihood of an average of 72 credits for AASs. The universities were at a max of 128 by our policy anyway, unless a waiver was granted. And we also had two campuses that early on went to 120 as a campus policy unless waiver was authorized.
Okay. Any questions from members of the committee? We have several bills on this topic, so we can just continue then. Okay, Senator Dill, we'll just lay over your bill for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill, and thank you very much.
Thank you.
This is an important issue we recognize. Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm here today with Senate File 579. Madam Chair, I'd like to offer the A1 amendment as an author's amendment. Statutory language. Okay, Senator Lynch.
Madam Chair, by way of discussion on the A1 amendment, what appears.
Okay, Senator Lynch moves the A1 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This will continue our discussion on the credit requirements. And I think the heart of this legislation is speaks to, we've heard about this waiver process, and this is another way to approach this that has been worked out, it's my understanding, between faculty and students and MNSCU as a whole. And I have two individuals with me at the table that I'd like to offer, will offer some further detail. On my right, I have Greg Mulcahy, and on my left, Jacob Littler. And Madam Chair, at this time, who would like to go first?
Go ahead, Jake.
Okay.
Okay, welcome, and please just introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jacob Littler, and I'm the president of the Minnesota State College Student Association. And I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to address you today. Senate File 579, as amended, aims to resolve issues arising from the 6120 credit cap legislation passed in 2007. When the credit cap bill was initially introduced and eventually signed into law, students were interested in the direct benefits that the policy would offer. Once the law was passed and the necessary policies and processes were implemented, it would lead to a detailed review of programs that would provide for accurate credit length information while also helping to save students time and money by reducing the credit loads of programs that did not seek a waiver or failed to receive one. In this era of ever-increasing costs for students and the corresponding debt loads with which students now graduate, the benefits of reduced credits and getting students into the workforce at a quicker pace were immediately recognized and supported by students. As part of the implementation of the original credit cap legislation, a task force, as the MNSCU testifiers already referred to, made up of students, faculty, and Office of the Chancellor staff, was formed to develop the criteria for a program to exceed the credit limit and the process of obtaining a waiver from the limit. After several long and lively meetings, an agreement was reached, which included both industry and professional standards as criteria for exemption, and would use the local existing local campus review policy, with a final review and decision coming from the Office of the Chancellor. And I'd just like to point out that under the understanding that we reached and the agreement that was made in that waiver process, all of the examples that were given from Ridgewater College would receive a waiver, especially for accreditation needs. If a student needs the credits to be accredited in their field to get a job, MNSCU would not be allowed to deny that waiver. That waiver would be granted. Those programs would go through, and those students would receive the skills that they need in order to get a job. That was very important to us as students. We want to make sure that whatever degree we're receiving, especially with the investment that we're making personally, we want to make sure that degree is going to get us a job eventually. So we did make sure that that was in there. And as far as from the understanding that we have of that waiver process, all of those examples from Ridgewater College would be granted a waiver, and those students would receive the skills that they needed. The established criteria gives program advisory committees and faculty members the opportunity to apply for a waiver under several different rationales. And we further interpreted the waiver procedure to require little more than a letter from a local business stating support for the current program length in order to receive a waiver from the credit limit. Students do not believe that this is a burdensome process, nor would it greatly increase the workload for faculty or administrators on campuses. However, there did continue to be great concern over the impact that this law would have on campuses and on students. We have heard major concern around the need to differentiate the Associate of Applied Science degree, the AAS. After months of discussion with faculty members on a local and statewide level, it's become very clear to us as student leaders that there's a need to address the inclusion of AAS degrees and provide more time for further discussion around all the issues surrounding these very specific terminal programs. And that's why I sit today before you to testify in favor of SF 579 as amended. This language will delay the AAS degree's inclusion into the credit limit and provide more time for needed study of how these programs differ from other associate degrees, certificates, and diplomas, and the implication of these degrees being subject to the credit limit. Under this language, no AAS degree would be required to meet the 60-degree requirement until 2012, and all new AAS programs would be able to proceed as if the time limit did not exist. We believe this is an appropriate step and will be a benefit to students after more discussion can occur around this subject. One such benefit to students could be added transparency in AAS degrees, allowing students to be better consumers and make wise decisions. It's often difficult for students to be educated shoppers because there's so much information on each program and there's the differences between the degrees, as the chair referred to, with certificates or diplomas offered in a specific field and AAS degrees also offered in that same field, and it can be very difficult for students to understand all that information and process, and a lot of times you end up with students simply taking what is given to them and taking the program that they're told will be best for them, rather than taking what may actually best fit their educational or career goals. So we do look forward to working with other higher education constituencies, including the Minnesota State College faculty and the Minsky Board of Trustees and the Office of the Chancellor staff, to find ways to make information regarding the programs offered by system schools more centralized and easier for students to access. And I guess, Greg, you can be up next.
Thank you. I'm Greg Mulcahy, the president of the Minnesota State College faculty, the union that represents the two-year faculty. As Jacob's alluded to, this language is compromise language. It's a compromise we can support. Our belief was that in any likely scenario, we wanted to have continued conversations with the students and the student leadership. We think much of the problem was engendered really by a failure of communication initially, and we think this will give us some time to take a real hard look, both from a faculty perspective and a student perspective, at what's appropriate in these AAS degrees. So we're in support of the compromise.
Okay. Any questions from members of the committee? Senator Lynch.
Madam Chair, I'll just comment that as I learned more about this issue working on this bill, I was frankly surprised at the vast number of AAS degrees that are out there all across the state, and frankly the the inconsistencies that exist. And I think in terms of our discussions about, you know, what can we do to ensure that our workforce is ready to be integrated into the workforce, I think this is going to be time and energy well spent.
Senator Roebling.
I just want to ask a little bit about the AAS degrees and some of the liberal art requirements that might be associated with those. How many courses are kind of the foundation courses, as they consider it, maybe in liberal arts and math or science? What does an AAS graduate have to have in those types of programs or courses before they can go into the actual field of study that they're pursuing? And then I know sometimes they can do those things concurrently, but what's the basic requirement?
Madam Chair, Senator Roebling, Minsky policy currently states that an AAS degree has to contain a minimum of 15 credits under the Minnesota transfer curriculum, fulfilling, I believe, is it three of the goal areas? Three of the 10 Minnesota transfer curriculum goal areas. So it's to give you that kind of the goal areas just covering communication, arts, math, humanities, things like that. So they want to give that kind of broad. You get three categories and then a minimum of a total 15 credits for an AAS.
So, Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling.
So that basically could take up one semester's worth of coursework.
Madam Chair, Senator Roebling, that's correct.
Mr. Butler.
Okay. And I don't know if that's, Madam Chair, if that's ever been looked at again. There's a lot of students I know who, do they offer them the opportunity to test out of them? If they would get those the right level of coursework in high school, can they test out of those and get credit for them, or isn't that easily available?
Minsky policy does, again, allow for credit for prior learning and testing like that, but that's something I would probably ask that the Minsky Office of Chancellor staff would address. I'm not exactly sure how all of that is implemented. So,
could I make a comment, too? I hate to answer with a non-answer, but part of the problem is these degrees are so diverse that sometimes you have outside groups that say we need this and this AAS for this occupational area. Some of them are clearly designed to be kind of a terminal occupational degree, and generally that's the principle, but not always. And unfortunately, in the world we're in, not always is usually the answer.
Well, Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling.
I have heard from some people in industry that that they feel that that their students are not getting the graduates of the programs weren't getting the training that they needed, and they're having to provide too much on-the-job training, and part of it could be because we've shortened the course. and they were not happy about that. And so I do, you know, I knew we had a waiver system in place, but I didn't know how that was working. And it sounds like it hasn't really started yet. So I'm kind of surprised that people were already telling me that if we haven't even gotten to the point of trimming courses back. And they're still not feeling satisfied with the level of work of the graduates. So I certainly would support this, but, you know, we always have that eye on cost and trying to get students through as quickly as possible. And I really want to encourage MNSCU to keep looking at ways where we can do dual enrollment opportunities. I know that the U of M has a big college in the schools, and some of the MNSCU universities offer that as well. But I think that to get those basic general ed requirements done ahead of time would really be helpful and would eliminate could eliminate a whole semester's worth of credits. And so we have to keep working toward that as we work toward keeping an eye on how many credits we're going to require in these courses. And so it's just something that we as a committee and MNSCU as a system has to keep working toward.
President Mulcahy, it would be a really good idea, as Senator Roebling said, if the colleges would reach down into the high schools and some of the students who are planning to get an applied science degree, if they could get started their senior year, then we'd have, you know, we could still have 72 credits and get done in 2 years if they went full time.
There is obviously a lot of attention on that throughout the MNSCU system. There's a lot of expansion in concurrent and PSEO.
Yeah.
And so that is going on quite aggressively.
No, St. Paul College is doing that.
Sure.
With students from the St. Paul schools. Yeah. Senator Lynch, if we support her bill, would like us to send it to rules so it could be included in the omnibus reform bill that's being assembled in the Rules Committee. So if this is kind of a compromise version, if members feel like they can support it, then should we make that motion, Senator Lynch?
Madam Chair, I would encourage the committee to entertain that motion, yes.
You can make the motion.
I would make the motion that Senate File 579, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Rules. And
since we're in the Policy Committee right now, we can do a direct referral.
Madam Chair?
Senator Roebling.
Is this reform bill everything, or is it?
Yep.
Okay, I haven't heard about it yet.
And there could be that we could decide in our omnibus bill that we also want to do something in this area as well. And we have another idea from Senator Erickson Ropes, and we had Senator Dill's idea, so we could still do something in our bill. Okay, you heard the motion. Then all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails.
Madam Chair and members.
Okay, Senator Erickson Ropes.
Afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members. We have a third proposal on the credit waivers, maximum credit waivers. As I think you have before you, the report of the task force on degree credit caps, has that been passed
mm-hmm.
out?
That's correct.
It's being passed out. You will note on page 4 there that they were recommending the development of a process dealing with waivers for program length, and that's what we've been talking about today. I have a simple one-sentence addition to add into the bill, and it addresses item C on page 4 of the handout that we just passed you. There are processes for exemptions related to A, industry standards, related to B, professional standards, but none related to C, unique challenges. And Madam Chair, I think you mentioned earlier when we were talking about Senator Dill's bill, you had the question about emerging or innovative programs, and our addition covers those unique challenges.
Dr. Baer talked about that, right?
Right. So I have with me today Russ Stanton with the IFO, and he will give you a little bit of background on the bill and who supports it and all of that.
Thank you. Welcome, Mr. Stanton.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Russ Stanton. I represent the Interfaculty Organization, which is the union for the state university faculty. We strongly support Senator Roep's bill. 2 years ago, the House adopted this 120 and 60 credit limitation. It was not in the Senate bill, as I recall, but in the conference committee, the compromise was to have the limit but allow for a waiver process. Then over the interim in 2007, Minsky set up a task force, and that task force had leaders of the students, the faculty, administrators, et cetera, that looked at the implementation of this legislation, and you have distributed the executive summary of the recommendations. Among the recommendations was that they wanted to have a waiver process, that it be broadened to allow for credit-linked exemptions for unique challenges, which were defined as emerging and innovative programs or programs of special need and merit. This bill simply lifts that language out of the report and would amend it into the law. I should say that IFO understands the reason why the original limitations were put on. I mean, they were put on to keep programs and institutions from padding credit requirements to build enrollment. And when programs do that, it's expensive for students. It costs them time. It costs them money. And in general, we would be in agreement with the limitations, provided that there is an adequate waiver process for programs that don't fit the norm. In general, most programs without a problem can be offered within 120 credits. Mm-hmm. However, we do believe that there should be flexibility so that if a program or an institution wants to offer a really excellent program, that might require more than the normal length of credits, that they could do that. They would have to go through the waiver process to do it. And the student going into that program would know up front that this program, it's an excellent program, but it's going to take more time to get through it. This legislation would not conflict at all with Senator Lynch's legislation. We're supportive of that legislation. I checked with the student groups. They're okay with this legislation. I checked with the two-year faculty unit union. They're okay with the legislation. I checked with Minsky, but they want to get the outright repeal. So this doesn't go that far, but it would at least give them a little bit more flexibility. No appropriation with the bill. Urge support, and thank you for the opportunity to talk.
Okay. Any comments, discussion? Then I thought we would just lay this one over for inclusion, possible inclusion. So Senate File 972 is laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you very much,
Senator Erickson Roep. Now, members, we're going to hear from the legislative auditor. I assume they are here.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Did we vote?
No, I don't think we usually vote when we lay them over, do we?
Okay. Well, some committees do.
Okay. Yeah. Your discretion.
You can also vote to include it, but I think we still need to have some discussion about what we're going to include. Okay. Legislative auditor is not here. Until 1:45. Oh. So do we want to go into the other committee and then go back? Annoying. Okay. The legislative auditor can't be here for another 10 minutes. So what we're going to do, Kara, is we're going to recess the policy committee. Call it the committee, Katie, not the division. We're going to recess the policy committee, okay? And we're going to convene the funding division.